This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully, everybody's doing well. I've been on the road. I'm home today. I'm working on some reports. I'm a little bit behind, so I need to speed and get those reports up. They take a long time to create. A couple things I want to just mention off the bat, and this is basically a comment I've made multiple times through this podcast over the years, and something that like kind of rings true and echoes to me, and something that I think we should all have a frame of reference in, and is, you know, we should be spending 90% of our efforts on 90% of the things that are going to create opportunity for us. And what I mean by that is, if you're putting a lot of emphasis on food plots and it's a small percentage of your property, it likely should result in a smaller effort. And so in this podcast today, we're going to talk about speeding up the time to create food or food plots on your property, but also it's taking into account the systems within your property or the systems that hold deer within your property. So your forest stands are essentially, or they should be designed to provide the predominance of the food to the animal, deer specifically, to provide the available cover in a form that they can use as well as feed on, and then directs and controls movement as well as distinguishes certain areas for certain conditions. So creating that concept of thermal neutrality where there's constants on the property where deer will be more inclined to leverage one area or utilize one area over the other. And creating that variation in landscape formation or landscape development creates an opportunity to hold deer all season long. One of your objectives isn't necessarily to inundate your property with deer. It's to hold deer for a reasonable amount of time. And for everybody that has smaller acres like me, I'm a 46-acre landowner. It's pretty small. I expect to hold the deer you know, some percentage of the time. And I don't want to overburden my landscape with deer because it degrades the landscape. So a lot of these properties that start to do some of this habitat improvement, they end up putting themselves in a bit of a pickle, and the deer that reside, they swamp the property and eat them out of house and home. And so it's best to be in an environment where there's a balanced amount of resources, food plots, agriculture, but beyond that, forage resources that are natural in the landscape to hold and maintain an animal's interest. And that's paramount to looking at properties that you're going to purchase and not being so individually focused on a small micro property or your individual property. It's looking at the big picture that gives you kind of a better framework to think about. I wanted to talk about building food plots today in the sense of the seed composition. So let me go back in time. In the early 2000s, I planted one of my first food plots, and I got a bag of seed given to me at a trade show, the ATA trade show, and I put it on my landscape for a fall food plot. I tilled the soil at a John Deere 1010, 1960, roughly, tractor, and I put in my first food plot with very limited resource, knowledge, education, what have you. I just threw some seed on the ground and things grew, and it did tremendous. My neighbor stopped by and said, well, you forgot the fertilizer. And I looked at it and said, oh, it seems to be growing just fine without the fertilizer. And, you know, when I think about those days, I think about how naive I was, but how resourceful I could be. And, you know, having inputs from people around you can somewhat dissuade or bias you into what's correct. Now I vision food plots completely different. I look at a three-pronged approach. We talked about that in a prior podcast. Mineral composition is one of those, balancing, of course, those minerals, plants, and biology. And looking at, you know, the three legs of the stool, so to speak, as an equal representation of success. Break. The most important thing we can do on our landscapes is to consider what is going to benefit the soil, what will attract deer, and then what will remain and be resident to keep not just deer, but other pollinators, other insects engaged. And most of the time we just think deer food, deer food, deer food. And we don't think about plants that are going to attract valuable insects, are going to remove pests, are going to fumigate or biofumigate the soil, that are going to help improve the system. And we just think about how we're going to get a deer to that location and kill it. And so the mentality to me seems somewhat counterproductive. I said earlier, we spend 90% of our time, or we should spend 90% of the time where the deer are 90% of their time. And that's usually in the woodlots. And so putting a large emphasis on food plots is, I think, important in the sense that it provides diversity of resources. But a food plot can also, you know, create cover resources. You know, they can create sanctum in and of themselves and be part of that three leg of the stool when we think about cover, food, and sanctum or sanctuary within our properties. But they're not going to provide the full plethora of nutrient demands for an animal. And so realizing that, I just want to start the podcast out with that as kind of some background. So what I did was I developed a pretty involved spreadsheet. It's got, I don't know how many tabs here, but a lot of tabs. And I've got a summary sheet that has about 60 different plants that I've broken down. And I've gone through kind of like the X's and O's of seed selection, utilization for purposes of developing seed blends. And I have developed my own seed blends for 12 years. I have been doing a no-till, no drill, so I don't need to use a drill, although I do have a drill now, system. So it was pretty archaic at first. I didn't have a roller crimper. I didn't have a tractor. I had a lawnmower. I've done some stuff by hand in my garden. I was able to crimp or break the vascular system of some of the plants to create a weed mat. And we'll talk more about that, you know, weed mat density, type of plants that create ideal weed mats, etc. But basically, I save myself time, and time is of the essence for everybody. I always want to speed up the process of things. And I if I can do it faster and get the same results, I'm doing it. And but I want the quality in there. So, you know, there's some underlying elements of this is balancing soils, having the right mineral content, creating the correct context for seeds to efficiently germinate and express themselves a part of the soil that they're bathed in. So the thing I would start with is thinking about, you know, what are we trying to do? And let's say, and this is really going to be focused on spring because this is the time of year where you're starting to think about this stuff. Let's say we have some carryover and we have plants that were winter hardy. So they were cool season plants that are winter hardy that survived the winter months that are starting to express themselves, you know, in the spring period. So they're starting to, you know, essentially, you know, produce, like in this case, I would use winter rye or wheat. They're starting to develop and they're starting to move into a longer vegetative state. And in that equation, I typically want to have four or five plants survive the winter months with a balance of plants that I can actually crimp. So basically roll over and break the vascular system. So the type of biomass that typically does that best is usually a grass. So grass will likely be in my fall blend. And then a grass would also be in my spring blend. So that would be something like oats or spring triticale, just as an example. That being said, that carryover plant's really critical for two reasons. One, you want to provide forage for animals. So carries over from the winter months, you want to play forage for animals, but you also want to have plants that fill an ecological void. And some of that could be building or recycling nutrients, extracting nutrients, building soil, organic matter, things of that nature. And so we look at basically everything a little bit in a box. And so that keeps us kind of organized in our minds, but thinking about what each plant provides on the landscape. And so typically when I'm developing a soil blend, I'm looking at, is it a nitrogen fixer? Is it a nitrogen scavenger? Is it a nutrient accumulator? Meaning, does it pull nutrients up from deep in the soil profile? Does it attract beneficials like pollinators and predators? And what is it doing for other insects in and around these areas? Is it a pest diffuser? Some of the plants that we include, chives as an example, around my apple trees or crab apple trees, release strong odors. And they can mask the plant. The plant produces odors and that repels some pests. Some plants are better at building soil. So focusing on plants that really do well at creating, you know, basic good organic material, or aggregate stability. A lot of those are grasses because of their fibrous root system. And then plants with really strong tap roots that are extensive that break up some of those compacted areas, and improving infiltration and aeration is really critical. So those are kind of like the soil ecosystem roles of some of these plants. And so I subcategorize them into each one of those sections and say, okay, these plants are doing this for me. And in my plant master table, I'm looking at basically several features, and I'm going to walk you through those at a really high level. So I want to know what family is it in. Is it a legume? Is it a forb that's a non-legume? Is it a grass? Is it a brassica? You know, what is it? What's its growth cycle? Is it an annual or perennial or biennial plant? Meaning, you know, how long it will survive? Is it a plant that extends one season, two seasons, etc.? And then, like I said earlier, what's its role? Does it use high water or low water resources? So like a low water resources plant would be safflower, small burnet. Those are plants that do better in droughty conditions. A plant that needs a lot of water would be corn, for example. A plant that needs a moderate amount of water would be sorghum. And then looking at the plant's architecture, that means, you know, the height of the plant on the landscape. And we want plants at a high interval, a medium interval, and a low interval, and variation of those. So we think about how much space a plant takes up physically and the dimensional height of that plant. So some plants are more upright and spreading. Some are just upright. Some tend to prostrate across the landscape. Some are in a viney form. You know, some it's a combination thereof. And then looking at the root type, and we usually break up root type into it's got a deep tap root, it's fibrous. Some are deeper than others. Some have a little bit more fleshy tap root. There's just variation in root type. But then looking at the root depth at maturity and then walking that plant back, how will this root do in this context of the soil based on the certain conditions that are persisting? I mean, some plants we know are really good at nitrogen scavenging as well as a deep tap root, and we think of plants somewhat in the brassica family. That being said, is it a warm or cool season plant? So most times you can plant cool season plants in warm season periods, and you can plant warm season plants in cool season periods. Don't set rules, but just realize that a plant's ability to express itself at full maturity might be limited based on time as well as the impetus to function. So some plants are C4 plants. If you've not heard of C4, that would be like a corn or sorghum. They do really well in heaty conditions. So when there's a lot of light and a lot of energy, the plant doesn't transpire. It photosynthesizes very well in those conditions. Where we have C3 plants like a soybean, they may not produce the same amount of output in heaty conditions. So it's having a combination of those plants in synergy with one another. So you're balancing the architecture, the root material. And one other factor is carbon to nitrogen ratio. Basically, that's a measurement of, I usually call it measurement of decay, but it's really the measurement of carbon to nitrogen in that substance. And so that's important to think about from how quickly the top layers of that material will eventually degrade. So plants like grasses, depending on its maturity cycle, will degrade real quick. And the structure within the soil, like the root material, will degrade also slow or fast. So it's looking at that plant for what its carbon to nitrogen ratio. We look at an approximate range of 30 carbon to 1 nitrogen, and 25 to 1 nitrogen is kind of the range that we're going for. So we'll look at the plant near bloom stage, so when it starts to flower, and we'll look at what its likely carbon to nitrogen ratio is, and we'll use that as a factor of how much of that plant we're actually going to use. Now, if we're trying to create a weed map, so look at very basic. Think about a grass that's erect, and think about a machine coming over and it knocking it down. And that machine is going to chop it, essentially, its vascular system, and it's going to lay it flat in the ground. And a seed source, which would be pre-applied, we'd sow our seed before we did this quote-unquote crimping. And now the seed is in a basically kind of structured environment where it has a weed mat at a certain depth. And this is critical. How much material actually matters in this equation? If you have too much weed mat, it's like a 2 or 3 inch weed mat, that may create a situation where the seed itself has a hard time developing and reaching above that surface layer to start to photosynthesize. So we want to ensure that, you know, we have a well-constructed weed mat layer. So that's a part of when we crimp. Timing's critical for crimping. Some plants in certain stages of their life will not crimp. Good example is we want to make sure that the winter rye or winter wheat hits a certain period of its life cycle. And let's say we have hairy vetch, and this is what I have going on in one of my food plots right now. You know, the hairy vetch is attached to that grass more than likely. And once you start breaking the vascular system of both those plants at like a certain window of time, you will be more productive in degrading that biomass from green to brown. We call that brown material. And the seed that's germinating underneath that will eventually, you know, come up through that weed mat and start to express itself. And some of that material will actually protect that plant from browse. You've heard, I think Jake Illinger was on this podcast talking about how he's planting beans in wheat stubble. And so that's a really good strategy for a lot of people to use some of that material to protect the plants. It's also looking at the height of that material to create concealment or cover for animals on the landscape. And so those are all critical components of deciding what seeds to select and what volume of seeds. And so in most equations, and this is my secret sauce, most equations, I want at least a grass component to not exceed 65%, but likely not less than 50% from a roller crimping standpoint. And so if you don't have a roller crimper, what are your options? You could do it with a foot stomper, basically a board, and then on the board, you put a bracket underneath it, and you've got a rope across, and you just step and step and step, and you can do it by hand. And yeah, you could probably do an acre like that without too much wherewithal in your body. You need basically something to spread seed. You could do it by hand. You could do it with a chest spreader. You could do it with an ATV spreader. You could do it with a cone spreader. Controlling the volume of seed is really critical. When I typically build my seed blends, I will separate my small, my medium, and my large seed. I will keep those in separate buckets, and I will spread those on the landscape independently. I don't like seed blends together because it creates unevenness in distribution. Now, people will argue that point, but I've been doing this for a lot of years. That's my system. That's what's worked for me. So typically, I've got a tool, and you can use a cement mixer, and you can mix up your seed. You can add your inoculation, your micronutrients to that seed. And the other trick is I want to make sure that seed that I'm putting in my mouth, I can put it in my mouth. So any seed with insecticide or some type of chemical, something that would eliminate your ability to ingest that seed is a negative. You should be able to take that seed and ingest it without any issues whatsoever. That's healthy seed. Now, when you add some of these additives on it, you know, like we use BioCoat Gold and Seed Flare, that's an example. You may have to inoculate peas if you're using peas or hairy vetch, just like we talked about earlier. That could be part of your seed blend. You might have to add some additives which aren't likely the best to ingest, but the seed itself should be of good quality, so it's finding a good quality resource, and it should be bare. And you can build your own seed blends. I mean, if I can do it, there's no question that you can do it. You just have to have a process. The most important thing in this entire sequence is looking at the duration or time period that you have frost-free days. So in my growing regime, I have about 130 frost-free freeze days, and that will break up my growing cycle. So how many plants or sequence of plants can I grow during that term? Can I grow three different sequences of plants? And these could be a combination of 5 to 6 different plants, and then I crimp them, then I sow down more seed, and then I crimp them, and then I get into the fall period. So this sequencing requires some thought process. A lot of the maturity cycle, and I have a maturity cycle for each plant, you know, could be 100 days, it could be 60 days, it could be 70 days. But most of the blends I do in the springtime have a 65-day crimp window. So usually they'll be ready to crimp in about 65 days. And that's going to change based on your soil type, what the related precipitation is, just the environment that you have. But my environment's relatively slow. Some are faster than others because of the amount of sunlight and the weather condition days and the windy days. That all impacts a plant's ability to develop. And so that's really critical in the equation. So when you're doing the system, you're going to have to be close to the plant. I also look at other factors like the fiber content of the plant and how digestible and utilized it is by deer. We look at the TDN, which is the total digestible nutrients. We're kind of like understanding from a food plot use standpoint what this seed is going to do or what this plant is going to do and how interested will animals be on the landscape. So things like understanding the total nitrogen production, the relative feed value, those are relative feed values, an index that we use to look at, you know, what the digestible dry matter would be for that. You can measure that. And overall, the mineral content is critical. But the biggest thing is balancing having a grass, having a legume, having a broadleaf, and having a brassica in that equation. That's what I would stress to you all. Make sure that you have a balanced plant profile. And again, you could have 2 grasses, 2 legumes, 2 broadleafs, 2 brassicas in that equation that deer will prefer, but also plants that maybe deer won't eat. So you keep the structure on the landscape and you get the system going. So I'm going to get into building a seed profile for you that works. Now, this is really contingent on your soil type and what previously has been planted. There is an element of nutrient uptake and slow release fertilizers as these plants decompose. But if you don't have a roller crimper and you're only able to use a flail mower, just as an example, there's going to be a higher decomposition of the plant from the fall to the spring. So we've got our winter rye or wheat growing and you run over it with a flail mower. And this isn't like a hammerhead flail mower. This is a knife cut flail mower with chains. And it basically chops it up in a really fine state and it evenly distributes it on the landscape. This is different from a rotary or a brush hog mower, and it'll evenly distribute it on the landscape, and then your plants will be able to ingest that essentially at a faster rate. It creates habitat for insects, and it's almost not immediately available, but available in a much faster rate than just roller crimping. Roller crimping could take anywhere between 3 to 7 to 8 weeks for that plant to eventually decompose where you don't see that rye or wheat on the landscape, just as an example. So it's important to think about, you know, how long that material is going to last and the expediency of it when it comes to adding nutrients back in the soil. That's not to say you can't apply foliar sprays to your plants as they start to germinate and develop to help them start to grow. You can certainly do that. And in some cases where you have weak soil biology, I would absolutely recommend doing that. Again, there's an expense to that you need to consider. So let's get to the gist of it. Building a blend that works almost in a regenerative sense. And the term regenerative to me is we're trying to focus on an easier way to do things that's not degrading the landscape. That's what that means to me. And having a spring planted blend that is designed for roller crimping that requires a specific balance of plants where we want some high protein forages for antler development and lactation. And there's enough structural biomass, which is the lignin and cellulose of the plant, that allows me to create a weed mat. And that's kind of my objective. So in this system, we're going to hit on four functional groups: grasses, legumes, broadleafs, and brassicas. The grasses are going to create the biomass and soil structure. The legumes are going to provide nitrogen and protein to the animal and provide that within the soil. And broadleafs are really good for mineral cycling. I always think of sunflower as one of the primary mineral cycling plants that I like to use. And brassicas for loosening soil and scavenging nutrients. Grasses are really well at expressing themselves, building soil and soil aggregation, but also leveraging some of the nitrogen that's available. And so the blend I'm going to just explain to you, this is a blend for my area, what I have a tendency to plant, and I have three or four variations of this, but I try to keep it simple. And keeping it simple is great because if you're building your own seed blend, you're resourcing stuff, you're not buying the buck on the bag, you're coming up with your own theory and expression of what you think is appropriate, and you play with this. You play with the numbers. I'm not going to get into quantity, I'm just going to get into percentages in the mix. So I'm not going to tell you need to plant 40 pounds of oats. I'm not giving you the exact prescription, but I'll give you a rough percentage that I'm going to plant on my property this year as an example. So the first component is grass. So in my example, this could be an oat, spring, triticale, and I might do a combination. I might do solely oats. I might do an oats for the first 60 days and a spring triticale for the next 60 days or vice versa. And basically grass is going to provide the bones. It's the foundation of the roller crimping for me, and it's going to have good palatability right off the bat for deer in the early spring. They're going to consume it, and eventually once it develops, it's going to create that structure to add moisture, to minimize wind conditions, and help these other plants photosynthesize. There's always going to be a legume in that blend. So grasses, in my example, are going to be about 60 to 65%. The approximate number is about 60%. So that leaves me with about 40 or 38% approximately other plants to have in this mix. I'm going to have 20% in spring peas or spring peas and hairy vetch. And I'll rotate those two. And vetch is high protein, high interest to deer. It will help attach itself, the vetch example and the pea example, to the grass. And as you crimp, it will act and form a part of that weed mat. And it will degrade at a very fast rate because of its carbon to nitrogen ratio. And it will produce and create a great amount of nutrient content to the next generation of plants. Other broadleaves I will use in this equation. So this is going to basically handle the last 10 to 15%. So broadleaves are going to be about roughly about 10%, kind of in that range. I typically like to use buckwheat and sunflower. There's a few other plants that I use. Again, both these have high attraction to deer. Some of the options that I've used in the past are less palatable by deer, but in this case, this is what I'm going to use this year. Buckwheat cycles phosphorus, and I lack phosphorus in the landscape, or I lack phosphorus availability for plants, so having buckwheat in there is sensible. And sunflowers provide great vertical structure and deep tap roots, and that's why they're highly consumed by deer, especially in that early stage. You know, deer will hammer sunflower because of its related palatability. And then last, I'm going to pick a forage radish, a white mustard, or a collard. And, you know, these are high energy plants. They will not really consume the white mustard, but they're going to help break up some of that compaction. And planting some of these cool seasons in the warm season seems a little bit strange, but remember, a plant's less likely to transpire or emit water content out of its stomata when it has a lot of these plants around it to create this good water cycling. Like, there's a little small water cycle that's happening within this little stand of various height plants where, you know, there might be CO2 exudated from the ground. It's being captured by the stomata. It's being processed. But even if a plant is transpirating, that moisture is caught by an adjacent plant. So they're kind of working kind of in uniformity. And how, why this all works is you've got a balance of different height plants. So their architecture is different and the root depth is going to be different. And so you're pulling from different resources, mineralizing nutrients, and then working really together. So I'm going to give you a couple quick tricks. And these tricks are just things that I've done over the years and work really, really well. This is giving you some secrets to my success. My tips is I have been using Seed Flare for the past several years on my seed. So I get my seed and you can, again, use a cement mixer. You spray it on in a pretty small rate. It's just, you know, not many ounces. I think 12 ounces or less, you know, per 100 pounds. And, you know, you spray it, mix in the seed, and then I add my bioinoculants in it. And that'd be my BioQuote Gold, Tanio, anything that you think is relevant based on your circumstance. For the peas, I absolutely inoculate the peas. I try to increase the volume of peas, usually during the spring period, as compared to the summer period with this crop rotation. I see deer just hammer the peas. I mean, I've been a big advocate of peas, even winter hardy peas, and I've seen a lot of success with, I've got clients that are putting 80 pounds of peas per acre down. They've kind of bought into that system too, and they see the value in it. But it's inoculating the peas for nitrogen fixation, and so you'll do that separately. One of the tricks of that is, I mentioned this on a prior podcast, milk, having milk, putting milk in a spray bottle, and misting the peas or the beans or what have you, and the milk will act almost as a sticker, and it'll allow the inoculation to attach well to that seed. So those are some tricks. You know, basically, I want you to look at the elements that we talked about. Do I have a plethora of grasses and broadleaves and leguminous forbs, non-leguminous forbs, those type of examples where you're going to have a variety of plants that are going to meet this sequencing period. So they all mature at a similar period, whether it's 60 days or 70 days or 80 days or 100 days. And then you have a plant after that based on this crimping cycle. And so you don't get ahead of yourself. You plant and have a plan. Some of the strategies we've seen over the years, I can think of one very prominent individual that really focuses on buckwheat, which is really one-dimensional. We want to be four-dimensional when we're looking at seed selection and profiles. And they just throw down their seed and then they crimp or they roll it over. And buckwheat does really well. You don't really need a crimper for that. Another little trick that I've used is I used to have a rototiller. And if you didn't have a crimper, you could use a rototiller to basically act as a crimper. You're not turning it on. You're just attaching it back to your three-point hitch or what have you. And it just runs over. And those fins basically chop the related plant. And it can act just like a roller crimper. And they're not expensive to build. I mean, you don't have to spend $3,000 to $4,000. You could, you know, get some end bearings and you could take a heavy piece of wood that's in a round form and you could just, you know, basically screw in L brackets and build your own for relatively inexpensive with some Unistrut, and you could just build the frame for it. Really simple to do, that doesn't cost much, and it's quite affordable and it's functional and it's keeping it simple. And it's using what you have and not trying to reinvent the wheel. But this system has been the least disruptive. It's been the most efficient. I can do acres of plants, like cropping within like hours instead of days. I'm not tilling. I'm not disking. I'm not spraying. I'm not doing any of that stuff. And I'm just rolling over material and I'm spreading seed. And everyone thinks it doesn't work. Well, it doesn't work because you haven't balanced your mineral profile. You haven't had a diversity of seed types. You've been polluting it with synthetic fertilizer. Nobody believes this stuff actually works. I've been doing it for 10 years, 10 years, and over 10 years at this point. And I have had complete success. You should see when my chemical profile comes back, when I do a soil sample, you should see how amazingly strong and healthy my soil is. It's so impressive. And what I'm suggesting is you can do this and you can save your time to more important things like working on your forest stand, working in your shrubland areas, creating the right structure, creating the right attraction. And those are the things that I suggest you do. think about this a little bit more. Think about what your process is. Not everyone has to follow this process, but this is the process that's worked for me and has been really able to accelerate the time that I need to focus on other things. And hopefully this helps, and we'll talk again next week. See you guys.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.